Hello and welcome to the Analytics Show, the podcast of business through the lines of data science. But together, we'll dive into learning and sharing where various industries are heading and how data and analytics is at the heart of shaping business growth and productivity. Let's spark different ways of thinking about data and analytics that is relevant to you and prepare your business for future disruption. I'm your host, Jason Tan. I'm delighted you could make it on this journey with us. Hey guys, to continue to get support tips, techniques, and tools, and learn from the expert, hit that subscribe button wherever you are so we can keep in touch and continue our lifelong learning together. Hello, welcome to the Analytics Show podcast. So excited to have you here. I know we have been connected for quite a while. I'm so glad we were connected again by our friend, Jeff Wade. So excited to see you here today.
It's awesome. Thanks for having me on, Jason. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Love it. Now, before we go to the heavy lifting about all those AI innovative stuff, let's talk about something that I have found about you during my research. You were awarded the President Volunteer Service Award by the U.S. President in 2016. Crazy. Tell us more about it.
Well, I've always been a big believer about give back and community service. And so my motto in life is actually try and leave the world at least as good as I found it, if not better. So I'm always looking for opportunities to give back, contribute, and it just so happened that year I did a lot of big things, particularly around the SDGs and stuff, that I was very honored to get recognized for that work.
Sorry, did you say SDG? What was that? SDG, do you mind to elaborate that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I keep forgetting that it's not a common term, but in 2015, the United Nations, they voted on 17 goals for a better world. And they're called the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. So they're things like zero hunger and poverty, good health, access to justice. You know, I won't go through all 17, but those are goals that they're actually trying to work to make happen by 2030. That was the commitment the member nations made.
Wow, right. That one, I think I have read about it. I think that part of it also has got to do a lot things that you do with the, I think you developed this whole program called AI for Good with UN as well. We will go into that a little bit later, but just freshing back that memory, what was it like? Did you meet the president like in receiving that award?
No, unfortunately, no. I would have loved to have met President Obama at the time, but they didn't do that for that kind of volunteer. They gave me a nice like pin certificate. You know, I got a little letter from the president. So
yes,
it was nice. But yeah, but Jason, you know, the funny thing is even though I didn't meet President Obama when getting that award, I've actually ran into him twice in my life.
Really? What were those two occasions? Did you say hi and say, hey, thanks for the award?
Well, it was before, both times were before the award. The first time he was running for president the first time. And it was actually at Sacramento Airport. I was on the tarmac, you know, doing some work, like helping out with some of the airport operations, like trying to figure out some improvements. And his jet at the time, I think it was called Obama One or something like that, happened to be there. He was outside on his cell phone. I think he was on his way to Hawaii for vacation or something like that. So, you know, being mindful of all the security, that kind of stuff, I saw him. I kind of just waved at him and he waved back. That was pretty cool. And then it was, I think, 4 or 5 years later. Again, I was on the tarmac of the DC airport. And, you know, they were going on and there was like, you know, he was actually outside the little area of Air Force One. So this time I didn't wave or anything because, you know, a lot of security, now he's president. But I remember he was kind of looking over in my direction and he yelled out, hey, did I see you on the tarmac of Sacramento Airport? And I yelled back, I'm like, Yes, I'm surprised you remember that.
I think that is it was a good idea not to do that. Otherwise, we'd have to go through the whole background check, background research, just to make sure that you were not stalking the president.
Oh no, I was more worried about like the Secret Service wondering who is that guy and is he waving or is he doing something, you know?
Is there anything on his head when he was waving?
That's why the president said something first.
What an experience. Well, I wish you will bump to him again sometime in the future again, but do make sure you are keeping yourself safe.
For sure, Jason.
I love it. Now, talking about some of the works that you were doing, so you are currently the Chief Executive Officer at ASIC Lab. Is that how I pronounce it? Or ACS Lab? How do I pronounce it? What is the right way to pronounce
it? We normally just say ACSI Labs, because it actually stands for Advanced Cognitive Science Institute.
Ah, right. Yes. Of course. That makes sense now. Tell us more. I think often we talk about AI, some people don't necessarily consider about that whole cognitive thing, but some people certainly do. And I think the future, hopefully I can see it in our lifetime, the real advancement of the AI has got to be the cognitive side of it. Super interesting to hear what you guys were doing there. Tell us a bit more about it.
I'd be happy to. I've always been about like solving large complex problems, and that's actually what we focus on. So our work is really centered around the convergence of cognitive science, AI, and the metaverse. Mm-hmm. So cognitive science, one of the big things we've all learned is that unfortunately the way we learn is still very much rooted in 19th century techniques. Uh-huh. So we don't exploit better ways of learning, and there are actually proven learning models that are more effective and more sticky for human beings, but because we've been doing it for so long and it works good enough, there's not been a whole lot of change.
Yes.
You think about some of the complexity of problems we're trying to tackle, like climate change, sustainable engineering, you know, finance. A lot of organizations are facing very complicated challenges, right? It's not like just here's one root cause. It's the whole sea of things coming together. And so the cognitive science aspect is kind of help improve people's cognitive abilities, help them become better creative and critical thinkers, and be kind of take the freedom to take a little bit more risk to figure things out. Now, nobody wants to destroy their organization, right, Jason?
Absolutely.
So there's some gun shyness about trying some of the more, we'll call it experimental ideas. And that's where the metaverse aspect comes in. So metaverse doesn't mean VR. It's really like Web3. It's like a digital or virtual world. So we exploit digital twins, replicate, you know, a farm, a mine, an office. You know, we have AI bots, that kind of stuff. So you can actually try your ideas and see what happens in a safe space. So if you totally bomb out on it, it doesn't wreck your organization. It doesn't hurt the damage, reputational damage, that kind of stuff. And then the AI component is if you're going to try some of these things, you have to understand what the outcomes are. And so the AI is taking a lot of information around socioeconomic and geopolitical and other forces, markets, all that kind of stuff to show what the results were. Not just the outcomes you're trying to generate, but the ripple effect across the board. And it's bringing a lot of scenario planning, so things you may not have anticipated to bear, or things that you might actually ironically think are black swan events, but are really statistically more likely. Like we had a financial institution back in October, they kind of ask about, we did a little bit of work saying like, you know, there's actually a threat to the banking system with some of these unsecured losses. And like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. That's like a black swan type of event, right? We've been through that before, not going to happen again. And of course, 4 months later, Silicon Valley Bank goes under. That very triggers a panic in the industry. And they come back like, hey, what was that you were telling us again?
I know, right? I think sometimes the hardest thing to really think about is the Black Swan event. And it's just such an outlier that we just think that it would never happen. But those who can see it often make a huge return. I wonder if anyone make a huge return on that.
No, but I'll tell you a quick story. Just, you know, we can't, as people, we sometimes can't get our own way. But In 2017, I was proposed using AI and generative design for viruses, and saying that, you know, generative design, you know, AI systems could look, if we teach them, they could actually look, figure out how viruses might mutate, how new viruses might propagate, or, you know, animal to human transmission or plant to human transmission. And if we do that, right, because the AI can fathom millions of possibilities, look at the probability and kind of put forward, we can look at what, if any of these are likely, but then we'd have the genetics of the virus. So in theory, we could start working on a vaccine before the virus actually existed. So we might have the ability to prevent an epidemic, let alone a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I presented the idea to some of the top people in the industry, the world leaders, like, well, you know, that's a very altruistic idea, that kind of stuff. But the price tag was $2 trillion. And like, we probably have to pull people off some life-saving work right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I totally get all that. But they're all saying, like, you know, the odds that we really have like a major epidemic, let alone pandemic, that's just not going to happen.
And of course,
that was 2017. You all know what happened in 2020.
Wow. Well, I can imagine that. I think going back to the where we were talking, there are such a big topic. I think you were talking about the creative thinking, how to think differently. You talk about the AI. You also talk about the metaverse. I think those are the really big three topics that we can explore. We're going to explore them one by one. But before that, I thought I would start with the metaverse. Is that the metaverse, the one that you were thinking, is that the version of Mark Zuckerberg is thinking? Or how is that going to be different?
They created a fictitious world for people to play around in. What the metaverse really means is just a digital representation of the real world. You think about digital twins. So you can clone your office into the digital world. You can clone your farm, clone yourself, right? Yes. That's the whole point. It's just, you're creating this immersive experience so that when you are experimenting with ideas, it feels more visceral and real. It's almost like you can get your hands on it, right? Digitally speaking. So I think it's, I can't remember if it's General Electric or Rolls Royce actually uses the metaverse to design jet engines. Tried this several years ago and they learned you don't need a physical space. You don't need to buy materials, right? If something goes wrong with the design and it blows up, nobody dies. But in this metaverse world, not only can you design the engine, you can stress test it in ways you can't do in the real world. Like, you can actually put it on a virtual plane and fly it at 80,000 feet, fly it through a thunderstorm or a heat wave and see what happens, right? That's the AI part, simulating what would really happen. That's not something we can actually do in the real world.
Yeah, I think that whole digital twin in the metaverse has a lot of application. Equally, that is a lot data and the AI components in there. Funny enough, when I was speaking to a gentleman, Grant Fullan, he is the CEO and the founder of Locomobi. He was talking about some use cases in the transportation. It's bloody amazing. Now, for the listener who are not familiar with the digital twin, and also the data and the AI components of the digital twin in the world of the metaverse, can you elaborate a little bit and share with them and us about those components?
Yeah, absolutely. So we talk about digital twins. We're actually essentially cloning something for the real world into the digital world. So think about your office. how the building looks, how the rooms are laid out, where the furniture is, you know, where the plugs are. You can clone all that into the digital world so it looks like an exact replica.
Yeah.
That's essentially a digital twin. You can do it with an object. You can do it with a location like Brisbane, the city. And I know they're actually doing some of that in preparation for the Olympics.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, or you can do it with people. So. I know a lot of people worry about deep fakes. That's the evil side of digital twins. That's somebody copying someone for malicious intent without their purpose. Mm. There are people that create digital twins of themselves for reasons they want to do. It's like, I can't name names. There are some celebrities that have created twins of themselves so they can do more commercials. They can do more fan engagement. So you're actually talking with them, or it's them selling you some coffee, but it's actually a digital twin of them.
Right. So how exactly do they create? Like, do they send out the plane with the camera or the LiDAR taking images of the entire city in order to get the data to create the digital twin? Or is that how it gets created? How does it work?
So you can do that. That's usually the best way. You get the most robust data to create a digital twin. But you can also do it just from photographs or even video.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, you can stitch together. Like, if you look at, like, Brisbane, there's plenty of photographs across the city where you can just stitch them together. And, you know, again, machines have that keen eye. They look at things at the pixel level, are able to then replicate that into the digital world.
Fascinating, fascinating. Now, talking about the whole creative thinking, I think one of the things that I have learned that you focus and you are championing is about the secret about thinking differently, especially in the world of the innovation of AI. Tell us exactly do you mean by that. I'm really interested to delve a little bit deeper in that whole topic.
Well, I really believe, Jason, that everybody has a billion-dollar idea. They really do. Whether they want to pursue it or not is a different story. But I think the challenge is people feel like they don't know how to come up with that idea. Right? They're like, look, and I've heard people, I'm not Elon Musk, I'm not Jeff Bezos, I'm not Steve Jobs, those guys have special, their brains are wired specially, right? I can't replicate that. That's not true. It's not like their brains are somehow wired differently. It's just the way they think about things. They look for, like, opportunities rather than threats, like when they see things. And that's the really thing. So when I say that you can think differently, everyone says that. You want to be an innovator? You got to think differently, but no one ever tells you how to do that. And one thing I did was actually look back at my career and say, how did I do some of these things? And I actually came up with a framework around that. It's actually the topic of my next book, which I call Tuckbo. It stands for think different, understand different, create different, be different, own different. And so, like, one common technique, like if you're wondering about an innovative idea, one technique to try and figure something out is to challenge assumptions. Right? Assumptions are things that we don't actually know the answer to, but we're going to assume that it holds true this way. And that's just ripe for picking apart. So one common assumption in the U.S. for a long time was you have to own a car. You have to own a car, right? Most people live in suburban areas, rural areas, this kind of stuff. Now, how are you going to get around without a car? And then one day there was a guy, he kind of started thinking to himself, he's like, you know, I'm a young guy. I don't have a whole lot of money, but the car is like the most expensive thing I have. I spend a lot of money on it, you know, insurance, gas, maintenance.
Yeah,
I don't really use it that much. And so he started thinking about it. He did some research. And what he learned was the average American spends about an hour a day in their car. So for 23 hours, it's just sits idle. That's not a great use of an asset, right?
Yeah.
So he challenged the notion that you have to own a car. He basically said, well, you really use a car on demand. So that person went on to found Zipcar. So basically... Wow. Came in and said, what if you could just rent a car It'll just be located in strategic areas nearby. You can go get the car with your phone, that kind of stuff, unlock it, all that. And if you only need it for an hour, you pay for an hour. You need 2 hours, you pay for 2 hours. That's it. And wound up disrupting the rental car market. So, you know, that's a good example of a challenging assumption. But then you had some other people come and say, like, well, why do you have to worry about getting a car? There are people driving around anyways. What if you could just carpool on demand? And thus, Share was born.
I love that. I love that. I have an even crazier idea that I thought about this whole thing, actually. I sometimes wonder, what if we just replace the entire car transportation system with vehicle with Travelator? You know, Travelator is the one that we use on the airport to help us to walk faster. Now, my idea, my challenge or my innovation or to think differently is that I think of it as a analog versus digital. And if I were to think that how the water is passing through the river, or car is almost like you are taking a bucket of water at a time. And because of that, that is why that is always a jam and during the peak hours, because too much bucket are trying to go through that funnel at one point. Whereas river, if you think about it in a digital way, that's no longer a bucket. People are just flowing accordingly. So that is how I that is how my innovative thinking about solving the congestion.
I actually like that, right? You actually take some of the variability out of the system and you have people actually traveling more at the same speed. That's actually a great idea, Jason. I'm serious.
Maybe.
I was actually trying to challenge the assumption, why do we have to travel at all? What if we had, like, in Star Trek, the transporter, right? I'm just in one location. That just needs to be somewhere else so I can get beamed over there. That's what I'm waiting for. Well,
I hope Elon Musk did that, and then he's going to build another company and get me in charge for doing that. On that note, though, I think the daunting part for most people, including myself, is easy to think. It's easy to come up some crazy idea. But hardest part is to the execution, especially this sort of execution. If we go back to that Travelator crazy idea, without the resources like someone else, like Elon, it's just unrealistic just to even to think about it. What is your comment on that in that sort of obstacle?
I mean, I get that perception, Jason, but what I've learned is that's not really true. If your idea really solves a problem, but more importantly, creates value, you can get resources. You don't go from idea to trying to build the whole thing, right? Kind of prove it, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've heard over 2,000 startup pitches in my life so far. And that's where I saw entrepreneurs get tripped up. They have this idea. They're talking about building something that they want, right? Mm. They're building a product or service that they want. They're not building something customers need. And that's really where the you comes in the tugboat, understand different, which is vetting your idea and saying, are you actually solving an unmet need? And essentially quantifying the value proposition. Because I found if you can do that, right, there are small steps you can then start taking where people will give you money and hire a team, you can get some materials, start building. But that's the process. I just, to be honest, go, that's the idea. We know what we need to do. We just got to go start building. I've heard people say, like, look, we know what the idea is. You can't spend time raising money all the time. Just give me $50 million off the start. And, well, from an investor standpoint, that's not how good risk management works. So, I mean, this whole thing's a process. It's I know it takes time, and it's like dating to find the right investors, startup team, that kind of stuff. There's really no way around that. You need the right people on the bus that buy into the value you're creating. So you have to find the right matches, because when you get someone on board, it's a marriage.
Right? Yeah.
And the course is messy and painful in the startup world.
It is. It really is. Now, speaking of thinking differently, innovation, we just talk about those things with the transportation. But I am curious, though, that you spend significant time in AI and also various industry. I read that you were one of the master innovator back in the old days at IBM. My question for you is, do you think this whole notion of think differently and innovation, is it very much the same framework when it comes to AI, or it would have to be completely different way to think about it as well, as opposed to a different industry?
You know, that's an interesting question, Jason. And really my experience, it's the same. Your approach to thinking differently and turning that into reality, it's the same. I mean, AI is, it's just a new set of tools and capabilities. You understand how to try and apply it. That, ironically, is the biggest challenge with AI. We're used to computers being about automation, right? Doing something faster or cheaper, less errors. That's great. And you could do some of that with AI. That's where most of the focus is. But you're only tapping into 20-30% of the value from AI. Right? AI, we call it the third generation of computing, because it has whole new capabilities. I mean, you're talking about a machine that could look at billions of variables, find subtle connections and patterns, and draw insights we've never seen before. And most people don't tap into that part of it, right? Because they're not used to thinking about computers as like an assistant. They're used to think of it as automation. And so if you want to think differently, that's what you got to do. So, you know, I worked on a research project where, you know, people that lose a limb, like a hand, could we restore mobility? And what we know is the brain can still send signals to a phantom hand. So, you know, technologists' first reaction is, okay, will Elon Musk this with Neuralink, drill a hole in their head, put a chip in, capture the brain waves, teach AI what those brain waves mean, translate that to robotic hand, right?
Yeah.
Done. But that's actually a lot of automation, right? We're just trying to automate the brain waves and automate what a hand does. I don't know about you. I'm not so cool about drilling a hole into my head to try and do that. But this is why having the right domain experts comes into play, because the most successful AI solutions I've seen to date come from domain experts. So we actually work with doctors and clinical researchers. And what they actually help us understand is, yeah, when the brain tries to activate your phantom hand, it triggers a process in your body. And part of that process is muscle and tendon motion. So what we learned we could actually do, their help, was put an IoT sensor array like at the elbow. And it could pick up those little muscle and tendon motions, right? We don't know how the brain works. We can't teach AI that, but we do know how the muscles and tendons work, and that we can teach an AI what those motions mean. And so now, and this has been going on for about a year and a half, 2 years, a person literally thinking about doing something, capture that motion, AI translates that in a robotic hand. So you see people down, they can make a fist, shake hands, hold a cup of coffee, drink from it. So some level of mobility has been restored. So thinking differently about how doing this rather than trying to just replicate what we know, it's the same approach, not just in AI, but in most things we want to try and do.
That is so fascinating. It's the first time I have just heard of those things that you described. And I like how you use it as an example of thinking differently. I never know about those things. How is the progress on that one so far?
it's been pretty good. There's work now trying to be doing, can we do that same type of thing with the foot? You know, obviously, anytime you start something new, it's time consuming as you figure things out, and it's a bit costly. The great thing about like technological solutions is that over time, they rapidly come down in cost, especially as you achieve like scale. So there's real belief that maybe in 5 to 7 years, we could really outfit people with a missing limb with a robotic version that they can use that like sensor array with.
Right. Earlier on, you talk about how sometimes the perception of the AI is about the automation versus the intelligence. Do you think that perception or perhaps that misconception has changed over the last few months?
You know, it's an interesting question, Jason, because I would like to think so. But ironically, in a session earlier today, people, it was plain to see they still think that way. They feel like that AI is like a supercharged search engine. It's like a more efficient way to get an answer that we already know. And that goes back to automation, where it's like AI has this capability to try and figure things out. It can actually help answer questions we don't know the answer to. That's the innovation part. And that's where we need to get more people thinking about.
Do you think that day will come soon? Or do you think that it's possible that AI will know the things that we do not know?
It's already happened. I mean, we've been seeing this for 12, 13 years now. I mean, it's not that it's new. It's just there's so few people that have realized that are tapping into those new capabilities. It's growing and ecosystems like I helped the UN build the AI for Good. You're getting more and more people starting to realize that, trying to do that. But it's a huge kind of cultural mindset shift, right? Because people are just so used to computers being about automation, about them being programmed and following a set of instructions. But it's tough for them to make this transition that, well, here's a computer that can do some activities that require some cognition. Help me out, right?
Can you give us some example to visualize what you just shared with us?
ChatGPT, right? Everyone says it's growing on the scene. I find it funny. ChatGPT has actually been around for a few years. Generative AI has been around for 10 years. You know, you referenced Local Motors earlier. That's actually something I worked on, I think, back in 2016. But ChatGPT reached a point of enough cross AI training that it could do routine tasks for like the average person. So before it was like designing cars or jet engines or helping to make music, but now it's like, oh, it can help me do like research, help me do my homework. But talk about innovation. Right at the end of January, a good friend of mine, she was telling me that her son is actually using ChatGPT for job searching. What's he doing? And she was like, he is basically given ChatGPT a raw resume, so like all his experience, all his skills, that kind of stuff. And he gives ChatGPT the job description, and ChatGPT then writes a tailored resume based off his experience and cover letter.
Yeah.
And he went like 17 for 17 in getting interviews. So I encouraged him to share. Sure, that's a great kind of innovative way to do this. So he did. And now, I think a lot of people started copying that. I see people now have actually built, you know, generative AI tools using things like ChatGPT or Midjourney to do exactly that, you know, help you craft your resume and your cover letter. And I think it's going to the saturation point now where if you're not doing that for your job hunt, you're behind the curve of everybody else. But I thought it was a very innovative solution when you first thought of that and started doing that.
I so agree with that. In fact, I agree to the extent that I actually built a tool called Engage AI where people are using it to comment on LinkedIn to break the ice and build relationship. Obviously, I always encourage that we still want to have the human in the loop where they can always add their personal touch on that comment. And like that, has been great. We have seen so many people using it. I think we have got about 30,000 plus people since we launched in January are using it in breaking their ice, the build relationship. I heard it's the same story. Some of the job seekers were using it to find a job just to get the attention of the hiring manager.
that's awesome, right? And you're touching upon something that's really important, Jason, is that things like ChatGPT, we call it generative AI, right? It's generating or producing something. It's not creating it. All it's doing is giving you kind of that first draft of something. You still need to vet out what's been there, especially some of the facts, and add to it and polish it up. And You know, this whole thing about prompt engineering is exactly around that. If you understand how something is actually created, you put the right parameters in there so that first draft you get, rather than be 40% done, could be 70% done. Like, one of my good friends is a photographer, and she actually uses DALL-E 2 and Midjourney, but her prompts are like 300 words long, right?
Yeah.
She's not just saying like, give me a picture of an avocado chair. She's like, I want a picture of an avocado chair. I want kind of this texture, this color scheme. I want this kind of lighting, this kind of shadowing. So she's putting all the things. She understands how photographs and images work and are created. By looking at that level of detail, she's like, I get like 95-98% of the way there with what I want.
100%. I am going to share another secret I am with something that I do with the ChatGPT is I am actually writing a book. And I admit that I actually have quite a bit of help with the ChatGPT. But to your point, though, is that my prompt is super detailed. It's almost like a few hundred words long. To help me to elaborate and to get the detail of some of it, and then I then update it with my personal touch. And I actually thought that it has made things so much easier while also help to convey the key point that I want to share with people.
But that's the point, right? It's to take some of the heavy lifting off of us. We can focus on more of the complex value add components to our work.
Exactly. Well, enough about me shouting out about myself. That is very good of me. But here is the key question. I think in the context of the AI-driven innovation, I think the biggest concern that lots of people have, including myself, is the ethical consideration. What do you think are those ethical consideration, whether it's the individual engineer who work on it, or perhaps the organization behind it, or the organization looking to implement it?
Well, I'm very big about the need for regulation. You know, it's part of my work as the UN's AI advisors to figure some of that stuff out. You know, what is ethics and what is moral use is more complicated because everyone has a different like moral code.
Absolutely. But
we live in the digital age where there's no boundaries on this technology, meaning that we have to figure out some sort of baseline. And that's another big kind of societal cultural change. It's going to take time, but we can't also wait to get everyone on board and agree on that. In the ultimate of ironies, I actually sit on one of the UN committees around AI governance, and it's kind of expanded out to kind of like science and technology governance. And we've been debating different kinds of frameworks and where a system like this who has a global credibility. And then the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, kind of, without us realizing, may have jumped the gun a little bit, or maybe not. Sorry, Antonio, if I'm mistaken. Was saying that the UN actually wants to create a whole agency just around to manage AI stuff, right? Which is one of the options we had been thinking about. You know, there are a couple other options as well. But that's, I think, how pivotal this has become to humanity as a whole.
I was going to ask you how the country or how the UN are perceiving, especially with that, the world tour that Sam Altman was doing for the last few months, that going around to talk about building the AI governance. Do you feel like all this awareness from what you described sounds like it is increasing and is taking lots and lots of copies around the world?
I mean, it is, right? This is the challenge that we have. It's a kind of a twofold challenge. One is that we actually have a lot of people working with this technology or creating AI tools that don't fully understand what they're doing. There's a lot of technologists out there, but they don't know all the ins and outs of medicine or finance or even marketing. And so that lack of domain deep expertise becomes challenging. And we've seen some of the pain from that. And then you couple that with the other major challenge is that historically as people, we're very reactive, right? We kind of wait for something to happen and then we jump in, figure it out. We think we have time then to course correct, but we live in an age where the pace of change is so fast. It's just so fast. The volume of impact is so great that if you're not switching to a proactive type of model and trying to anticipate different uses or misuses, it's already too late. There's a county in California, I probably can't name which one. You know, everyone thinks like, okay, self-driving cars 20 years away, AI automation of jobs 20 years away. There's plenty of time to figure things out. There's a county in California where, you know, we've been doing some workforce development in the state. People were skeptical, saying like, yeah, AI is not going to jump in and do some of these things for, you know, 20 years or maybe never. We don't think AI can do that. One of the counties actually came back a couple of months ago and they commissioned some independent study and they basically realized 30% of our jobs are in hospitality and transportation. We've seen with generative AI like ChatGPT was kind of the trigger. They now realize that they're at much greater risk than they realized. They commissioned this study and there's a very real plausible case in the next 2 or 3 years, they could see 3% of their workforce go unemployed in the span of 8 weeks.
And yeah.
If that happens, if even 10% go unemployed in the span of 8 weeks, we don't have the resources to pay unemployment benefits. We don't have the resources for worker retraining. We don't have the resources for this. We don't, you know, we have all these students going through educational curriculum that are basically being prepared for jobs that won't exist anymore. And now they're realizing, oh my God, what do we do? Right? We don't have 20 years. We don't even have 2 years to get ready for this.
That is a tough question. And I think we all just have to be prepared for it. And I think it's one of those consequences come with the innovation. And speaking of consequences, I suppose, on the other side of coin of the success coming from the innovation, often it also comes with failure and setback. In this world of the AI and that sort of failure and setback sometimes has met with higher volume and the voice of the critics. How do you think we should embrace when failure is inevitable?
Well, look, failure is not a bad thing. Obviously, it's a great way to learn, but you don't want to fail spectacularly, right? You don't want life damaging or business threatening kind of failure. But I think it's also a testament that we do a lot of things that we don't fully understand how they actually work. That's the shocking part, right? True. You know, you think about like teaching AI a language. Right? We always think about big data, all this kind of stuff. And for an AI to become fluent in a language, it basically has to hear about 100 million words or phrases, right? Great, it works. But a human child only needs 10 million words or phrases. So it's not the volume that matters. There's just certain words and phrases that somehow trigger cognitive stimulation. The problem is, learn our first language, we don't have the way to communicate which of those words and phrases are connecting. So we don't fully understand like how we learn languages, right?
That is same, so true.
Same thing that, you know, there was a project in Nairobi, Kenya called Loving AI. Told the listeners, probably not what you think, but the whole goal was, could you create like an AI system that could be there for people that suffer loneliness, right? Before COVID, loneliness was definitely the biggest illness in the world. About 40% of people suffer from severe to moderate loneliness. So could you teach an AI system unconditional love? So not for these people to replace human relationships, but always have a safe space and feel know that there's something they're connected to no matter what. So they don't feel alone. And think about that. It's like AI can only do what you teach it. So how do you explain the concept of unconditional love, right? Then you start thinking about, well, why is it unconditional love? Does that mean there's different kinds of love, right? Is there love and then unconditional love? And then when you think about love, like there's love between two spouses, between two friends, parent and child. So it became this really deep kind of, you know, thought exercise into what it means to be human. But people started going like, we don't really know the parameters of love, right? We kind of experience it. We subconsciously or consciously, we think we kind of do. We don't actually have a way to break it down.
Yeah.
And that's what I think we found in life, is that there's lots of things we do, just even work things at work, that we don't fully understand how it actually works. And that's the big challenge with AI, right? If we can't explain that, it's not going to do a great job, or we miss something, then that's the problem. That AI is probably not going to work right. And then, of course, you have the bad actors that, when you do build tools, will find ways to misuse them. So it's kind of this whole stagger type of thing we're trying to deal with. There's no easy answers to that, other than we all have to learn how to think differently, Jason, right? We're shifting away from how, okay, you follow these steps to do the work, to understanding, okay, how does this work actually function, right? What are the parameters of it? That's why you see, you know, prompt engineering is all about parameters. Mm. That's why it's become the hottest skill set out there now. Everyone, I think, in 10 years is going to have to understand prompt engineering. Whatever work you're doing, you have to understand the parameters that actually go into it.
It's funny that I was talking to an associate professor, and then he thinks that maybe one day we would have to have a job called prompt trainer. So prompt trainer is to train people how to do prompt engineering.
Oh, 100%. Look, I had someone the other day tell me they were trying to use ChatGPT to figure out how to network, and they're like, it wasn't really helpful. It's like kind of bland and generic. I'm like, well, what prompt did you use? I said, that's simple. I just said, you know, I just went to ChatGPT and like, what's the best way to network? Mm. that is not a good prompt at all. So all you listeners, look, do not do that. That's insufficient parameters and data for ChatGPT to give you anything meaningful. So I was trying to explain to them, like, you know, you got to be more specific around the parameters. Why are you networking? What are the outcomes you're looking for? What channels? I gave the example, like, maybe you want to say, like, go to ChatGPT, what's the best way to network on LinkedIn with financial professionals so that I can get a job at an investment bank? You know, as this type of, you know, role, like a financial analyst with 10 years experience, whatever. The more parameters you can put in, the more robust output it's going to generate for you.
100%. Often I tell people that you need to give it context. You need to give it a lot of context in order for it to generate or provide a better result. I so agree. I'm so glad you shared that. Now, coming back to where we were talking about the AI, can you share some real world example for all the things that you have seen in the UN and some of the work that you have done, some real-world example or success story where the individual or organization have embraced innovation and leverage AI to achieve some remarkable outcome?
Yeah, so, you know, working with some of the countries and NGOs in Africa, one of the big challenges is actually healthcare. I think if I remember the stats correctly, there's about one doctor for every 2,000 people.
Oh, wow. And
I think the average distance a person is away from like a doctor or a health clinic is about 70 kilometers, right? So accessibility is a challenge. And understanding the limitations of some of the infrastructure, like necessarily don't have high-speed internet. What we did was we actually helped design a tablet. And on the tablet is a self-contained AI system that knows some basic, well, more than just basic stuff around health and things. So if someone falls ill or gets injured, anybody in the like the that little area can grab this tablet, you know, put in some information, use the camera to help the AI kind of scan in. The AI will prompt questions, get the thing, and then if it's treatable, help show the person how to treat the injury or the illness. Or if it's more serious, then say, look, we got to call for a a helicopter or something to evacuate the person. So in effect, by doing that, we turned, you know, the average person into like a physician's assistant. So at least improves some accessibility to healthcare. And all you need is to be able to keep that tablet charged. Structure consideration.
That is a great example. Now, to summarize to all these things, what are the advice do you have for the organization to really embrace, incorporate innovation and think differently and innovate AI into their organization?
I mean, the first is you have to make a commitment to want to do that. I know a lot of companies say you want entrepreneurial thinkers, but then they're not really open to new ideas, the resources behind it. But if you're serious about that, you have to create the culture and environment to support that. I mean, my IBM days, there was the system that if you had an idea, you could put it forward. You know, obviously you have to have the business case and the things for it. But if you put forward an idea, the process was set up that in 3 weeks or less, you had a chance to pitch your idea, try to showcase the value, and you'd have a decision on whether a company wants to move forward with it or not. So there was a channel to do that. So you got to do something like that. But you also got to essentially teach your people how to think differently. And that's like where my Tuckbo framework comes in, because I've had a lot of clients now actually take it and use it for their own things. And I've actually, ironically, had some people use it personally, like for their own, figuring out their own career path, which I hadn't thought of before. But I mean, there's a lot of frameworks and tools and things like that. But if you really want to do it, you got to commit to it.
Absolutely. On that note, what is the best way for people to reach out to you? Is LinkedIn, Twitter, your website the best way? Which way would be the best?
Yeah, I mean, I actually publish a lot on social media. I'm very active. I actually have a LinkedIn newsletter where I share a lot of the stuff around like AI and the metaverse in terms of business use. You know, my book, On the AI Revolution, was a bestseller. So it's a great source if you're wondering about AI and use cases. But, you know, if you have questions or you want to bounce an idea off, or you're wondering more about Tuckbo, I explain what it is on my website, which is just my name, neilsohota.com.
Can I give you a plug about the book that you are publishing soon?
Yeah, I would appreciate that. That's actually about Tuckbo. So it's a much deeper explanation about how that works. You know, I know, like I said, some people reach out, they have me do some workshops for their people. Happy to do that. But that's the thing in my next book, and actually show how people have applied Tuckbo to create new innovative products and services.
I love it. I would have to keep an eye on that and get a copy when it is released. Now, here are the two final questions I have got, Neil, before I let you go. The very first one. What is your most important first principle?
My first principle is always, what's the value you're trying to create? I'm a real big believer. You have limited time. You should be focused on what's the value you're really trying to create. I'm not saying don't go binge watch Yellowstone or something like that. Obviously, everyone needs downtime. But there's some value in doing that for you, right? Or for your community. Maybe your spouse. I don't know. But always, that's always my first principle, is what's the value I'm trying to create.
I love it. What is one book that you have read and thought it would have been better for your younger self to have?
Oh man, that is actually Getting to Yes, which is actually ironically a book about negotiation. But I'll tell you, I wish I'd learned this like when I was in elementary school. We always talk about people, process, technology. Process is really mature. We've really been able to develop robust technological tools, but it's always the people challenge. That's what I found everywhere. It's always like a people challenge. How do you get buy-in? Most people don't like change, you know? How can you show and craft the value propositions? How do you communicate effectively, you know? It's those things that are really important. And Getting to Yes is actually a great book because it kind of forces you to think about the other person, what they value, so that you can figure out, do you have the right value proposition for them? And then how do you communicate to them in terms that they're looking at and thinking about, not what you're thinking about?
Exactly. And I think that is probably even more important for the engineer, for the analytic professional, for the people who work in data, who work in the AI. I think all of those people like myself and yourself, we like those industries for a good reason. But equally, I think they are part of our personality where it makes us good at those doing those things. But equally, not so much, not speaking for everyone, but I think speaking in general, few of us probably face more challenges in communicating, in negotiating, in getting the yes. Highly, highly recommend people to read that book, but also to embrace the idea of talking to people, dealing with people. That is what makes a huge difference.
100%. I always tell people, don't be like Steve Sassoon. You don't know who that is, right? It all goes back to Kodak. So if you're old like me, you remember Kodak was the king of film for like over 100 years. And they eventually got killed off by digital camera. You know, digital camera started coming out in 1996. Yeah, the quality wasn't as good as film. He said, no, people aren't going to switch. And of course, technology gets better and cheaper fast. By 2000, they had knocked Kodak out. But do you know who invented digital camera? Steve Sassoon, Kodak engineer, in 1976. So Jason, Kodak had the technology 20 years before anybody else, right? Obviously, back then it would be expensive to develop, but you could still do that. But Steve Sassoon could not communicate to the executives the value propositions, the benefits, what this means. Right. All they knew is that it'd be expensive to pursue. And if it actually worked, it would cannibalize their film business. They didn't understand the other opportunities because Sassoon either didn't understand how to communicate that or didn't understand that's the thing they would actually value. You talked a lot about the technology, not the benefits. But just imagine for a second, if Kodak had pursued that in 1976, where we would be today. I mean, forget about us having Kodak phones and Kodak laptops. We'd all probably be living in the metaverse already. That's probably how quick they proceeded 20 years earlier.
What a story. What a story. I never know that part or the deeper detail about that whole digital camera, but I so agree with you. I mean, what a world we could have lived in should we have pursued that whole digital camera direction 20 years earlier.
So that's why sometimes it's not the idea that's the most important, it's the ability to communicate the value.
Exactly. And that is exactly where I was thinking about the whole, giving myself a talk again about engaging. It's about how to help people to communicate better. And I so agree with you. Well, thanks so much, Neil. It has been a wonderful podcast interview on the innovation, AI, and how to think differently, as well as the metaverse. That once again, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jason. Thanks for having me on the show. I had a blast during our conversations. This was a lot of fun.
Well, the pressure is mine, I can assure you. Thank you. If you enjoyed this conversation, hit that subscribe button so we can meet again. If you don't, I'll be stuck in an infinite loop. So pull that plug by clicking the subscribe and help me out. You can further support us by leaving us a kind review from wherever you are listening. At the end of the year, I will choose a reviewer to send a special gift to, and it might just be you. I look forward to seeing you here next week for a new adventure. If I can find my way out of this endless loop. See ya. Thank you.